Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larima, today joined by Anlu Kiva. Anlu, how are you doing?
Hello, Nicholas. Doing well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm usually doing pretty good on a Friday, although apparently there's going to be a big wind in Cape Town, so I'm battening down the hatches for that. We're also joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you, sir?
Big news in my neck of the religious woods.
Indeed, and we will get on to the election of the new Pope, the first American Pope, later on in the show. But in the meantime, let us stay focused on South African affairs. And the first thing we're going to talk about are some comments made by Mbuyiseni Ndlozi, formerly a senior member of the EFF, who has since parted ways with the party. And is kind of, I think, trying to invent himself now as South Africa's foremost far-left intellectual. He was speaking at an event with Moletsi Mbeki about economic solutions for South Africa. Moletsi Mbeki was, I think, said some very sensible things, but we're not going to focus on what he said today. We're going to instead focus on what Ndlozi said. He said that the public sector wage bill, which was something that Mbeki highlighted, was not anything of real concern. He says South Africa's difficulty with creating jobs has, quote, nothing to do with how much we tax capitalists. He said the crux of the problem was what he called deindustrialization, which has happened because the economy has focused on quote, financialization. Financialization means you're not investing in the productive sectors of the economy. You're not building factories as capitalists. Unemployment is the fault of the state and the investors. Their wrong investment decisions are responsible for this. He said that there needs to be a shift in investment decision-making towards labor-intensive, product-based sectors of the economy. He said that he was essentially here seeking to copy some of the localization plans of Donald Trump on focusing manufacturing from overseas to South Africa. He says that South Africa's macroeconomic policies have not been hostile to business, and that democracy has benefited capitalists, making them wealthier than during apartheid. He said, quote, democracy is not disruptive to capital. He said that this argument that South Africa needs to be a stable country before investors will invest, he replied to it saying, South Africa is stable. We have democratic elections. In fact, there are 16 by-elections taking place next Wednesday. You have people who accept electoral outcomes, and you have a new government with a ruling party lost power and agreed to share it. There is political stability. And he said that this was more than enough room for investors to be willing to invest in the economy. Terence, let me start with you. This seems to me, I mean, kind of what you'd expect from like a kind of Marxist-Leninist like Ndlozi, the idea that finance in of itself is just like an entirely useless sector that you could just kind of get rid of, that we must just build productive things. I guess bricks and widgets and screws and machinery and all those kind of cool things, the sort of things you can, you know, you can hold in your hands and feel. But the reality is the economy is a lot more complicated than that. It's not so easy to just wave your wand and declare a factory to produce things. Indeed, if you're not making a profit, you are subsidizing that factory. And you can't subsidize every factory because eventually the money runs out. I don't know, Terence, what's your take on all of this?
You know, the problem is that the quality of Marxism has declined somewhat in recent generations. You know, Marx himself, you know, reckoned that you needed the profit motive in order to, you know, give you an incentive to create stuff. Now, I do take some of the point about, it would be more perhaps more socially beneficial if you were building factories, although, you know, Greta Thunberg would descend on us and start screaming about our carbon footprint, so maybe not. Maybe, you know, 40% plus unemployment is a small price to pay for avoiding her attention. But yeah, look, the thing is that South Africa is just really not, for many of the reasons of, for reasons that his party would probably support, crazy labor legislation, kowtowing to unions, visceral hatred of business, ratcheting up empowerment demands, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. South Africa, there's very little South Africa can produce that anyone else is going to want to buy, even South Africans. You know, it costs less to, post something from China and buy it here. So the idea is, we're going to subsidize. Well, for that, by the way, you need finance capital, but, for anybody who's seen the movie Shadowlands, Anthony Hopkins, beautiful movie, there's a line where the character of C.S. Lewis is sort of teased by one of his colleagues that, I see you as a species of medieval saints selling holy items of dubious authenticity. The idea is easy answers to difficult problems. And let's just say that somebody else is peddling some pretty dubious icons here.
Yeah, no, I think that's very well put. This is kind of the fatal conceit of socialist planning at the end of the day, Anlu, is that Ndlozi believes that were he to have all the powers of economic decision making in the economy, that he would be able to direct the economy in a more productive direction. He apparently has missed what happened to the planned economies of the Soviet Union. But be that as it may, what's your take on this?
Yeah, well, many of the proponents of it misses exactly that very important section of history. So I agree with one. It's a slight agreement. It's a little bit hard to find it, and you have to actually go looking for it. But the point is that government is not, it's not the role of government to create jobs. It is the role of the private sector. But the thing is, it's not possible for the private sector to create these businesses if government constantly put their hand in the business and tell them where and how and on who to actually spend their money. And if you don't create a favorable business environment, you can't expect of the private sector to actually expand and by that thing to create jobs. And somebody said that in the comments, a brilliant brand new idea is maybe just don't kill business, just create a favorable environment.
Yeah. Funny thing, Before you can heal the patient must be kept alive. Yeah, if you're on Dr. Zhivago, there's a lovely discussion about that. You want to operate on the patient, but first the patient must live.
Yeah, no, definitely, Terence. And the thing is, Nicholas took out one very specific thing that Ndlozi said. I'm so happy that he actually mentioned it because I made a note of it. And that's that he said that the current policies or macroeconomic policies is not actually hostile to business. So he's saying it's not killing the patient. And he's sitting on the pile of garbage policies saying that it's not hurting business. You can't pretend, or at least we will not pretend, that those consequences don't exist. And then there's one last thing that I noted that he said that I want to really draw attention to. Sorry, Nicholas, I'll be quick. He completely dismissed the statement that South African or that business needs a stable country or stable political environment before they can actually invest. That point that you made, that we have by-elections and we have the people accept the election outcomes, that is not the only element that goes into a stable political environment. You also need favorable policies for government, a favorable working environment. From top to bottom issues.
If I can chip in there. This has also been something that the government has been saying since the 1990s. Oh, it doesn't really matter what your policies are as long as they are predictable and stable. Well, you can have very bad policies that are predictable and stable, and then people just know, no, don't go there. You know, it's kind of like if you lace a piece of meat with arsenic, you know what the result it is, and therefore you know the appropriate action to take. Which, by the way, for those of you who haven't been paying attention, is not to eat it. Right. Now, what we've managed to do in South Africa is we've managed to make things, bad enough that people don't want to touch it, just unpredictable enough that they can't plan around that. So it's a true marvel. the sort of sour spot between unpredictability and bad policy.
Yeah,
I think
Nicholas, can I say, I'm very
ahead,
sorry, we're having a discussion here. I just want to add one very important part of having a stable government and stable political environment is having an actual budget, which we don't have. So there's no reason for him to say that we have a stable political environment if we don't have a budget even.
Get a budget. Very important thing, folks.
I do think that in some ways stability can be a bit overrated. You know, North Korea has, I wouldn't say stable policies, because Kim Jong-un can decide to change them, you know, willy-nilly, but you can probably expect that he's not going to tomorrow declare that we're open for business and we really want to build a finance sector. I think this kind of really does show how out of touch the sort of intellectual world of the EFF is with, quite frankly, economic reality. To make the claim that the economy, that the capitalists, as they are demonized by Ndlozi, are not negatively affected by government policy, as you were saying, Anlu, I think is on its face just kind of mad. In their world, if you haven't banned the capitalists outright, then you've given them, you know, all the space they could possibly ever need, and they should be thankful for, you know, not being nationalized all at once. And I think this is this kind of detachment from reality is because of the fact that a group like the EFF's policies, they haven't been fully implemented, shall we say, in South Africa. You know, we still have private property in the constitution. We still have, you know, a private sector, things that the EFF has basically said that if they were, you know, in power, they would get rid of. But we have tended in that policy direction. You know, we've kind of drifted increasingly towards the sort of socialist model, and it hasn't worked. Unemployment is high. Crime is out of control. Many South Africans languish in poverty and misery and are not able to access opportunities or a better life. And so now we have to pretend like a real socialism hasn't been tried yet. What we need to do is triple down on everything we've been doing up till now. And I think this kind of shows at the end of the day how hollow some of these intellectual approaches and Ndlozi is not in the EFF anymore, but he's definitely part of that intellectual world. Anlu, you said earlier, sorry, we're having a discussion. I never apologize for having a discussion on a podcast. But Terence, any final words before we move on?
Hey, I hang my head in despair sometimes. Unfortunately, people who need to hang their head in despair, or at least in reconsideration, can seldom be prevailed upon to do so. Yes, right. What can you do?
Indeed, indeed. Okay, staying on policy, but from a different political sphere, we're going to be talking a little bit about Action SA, and they are announcing their alternative to BEE, I think is a fair way of framing it. The title of the speech given by Herman Mashaba outlining this economic plan was called Action SA Announces Bold Initiatives for Meaningful Economic Justice in South Africa. Now, originally, I believe one of the stated reasons that Herman Mashaba said that he left the DA was because of the DA's opposition to race-based black economic empowerment. So I think it is fairly interesting that this is being put out by Action SA now. But anyway, they list five parts to their plan to create what they call economic justice in the country. These five parts are inclusive economic empowerment, social investment grants, housing, land reform, and spatial justice, gender justice, and social cohesion. The first of these, I think, is the most important, which is the inclusive economic empowerment. The proposal here is to move away from BEE to what they say is a ground-up approach rather than a top-down approach. They say they want to replace the BEE framework with a opportunity fund levy. So instead of spending money on BEE compliance, all companies will have to give 5% of their profits to the state, which will then spend it on what they call the foundations of opportunity. These are roads and education and all that kind of thing. Mashaba says, for this to happen, we appeal for economic patriotism that I guarantee you will not be linked to a toxic system of patronage. We invite big business to place public good at the center of their corporate action. He talks about closing loopholes for tax avoidance and business auditors who help corporate clients dodge their tax responsibilities will be subject to significant jail term. At the same time, Actioner says they want to table a draft resolution in Parliament, which will create an ad hoc committee that will investigate, deliberate, and shape urgent reforms aimed at achieving transformative economic justice. Anu, your initial thoughts on this one? You're muted, Anu.
I made a joke and then only I laughed at it. I said word salad.
I know that feeling well.
So there's just something that I noticed in one of the articles that I read, and I made a point of it to every time I noticed it to point it out because I can simply not let it go. It said that the Action SA with their 6 seats in National Assembly played an important role in halting the 2025 budget that included the 0.5 percentage point VAT increase. That is absolutely not true. They supported it, and we cannot be told that 1 + 1 = 3. So anyway, then we'll move on to what they now propose as the Opportunity Fund. So I usually like to just simplify things for myself. And if I simplify this, what I understand they're saying is that they think the country is not doing very good at the moment. Whether they measure that as growth or whatever they use as their measurement, then they say, okay, let's go ahead and now tax companies more. That's essentially, according to me, what they're saying. And in this, they're saying that the current consequences of BEE, what they see the effects of BEE is not in our best interest. So they propose just to then increase tax on companies. They don't mention race. I didn't pick up in any of the reading whether this fund will be allocated to specific people or according to specific criteria. But I suppose there's some assumptions that can be made. I think they did not think this through. And they say in one of their statements, they said that the current system actually just reinforces the inequality. And they propose that, it reinforces the inequality. I had a little tongue twister there. Reinforces the inequality under the guise of empowerment. But that they will now, what they propose will come at, actually, they will use it to invest in real people. And the problem here that I think we very clearly need to point out to them is that they did not think about it and that the companies, which now has increased costs, will actually just transfer this onto the consumer. And at the end of the day, it will affect those very people who they want to protect now, or the real people in which they want to invest. And it will cost those people jobs at the end of the day. So trying a different iteration of the same problem is not going to be the solution. They need to actually sit and think, what is the issues that is causing government inefficiency? And at the very same event, I don't know if you mentioned it now, but we mentioned it in our pre-discussion that Mletse Mbeki spoke at it, and he said something profound to me that I just want to draw some attention to, is that the problem is a tax system that transfers wealth from the productive finance sector to the public sector, primarily as compensation for those with political power. That's the actual problem. And then there's a very important growth argument that we need to make here, which is that they obviously put a limit. So SMEs are excluded at the moment, and what they do is they put a growth limit, essentially. BEE does the exact same thing. So I don't know how they think the Opportunity Fund will actually help these people. They put a growth limit on the SMEs because, I mean, who's going to want to grow your business if you, at the end of the day, just need to pay more corporate tax in the sense? So, yeah, luckily for Action SA, I want to throw in a little good point here. Go have a look at the Institute's No More Race Laws Bill. Much better than your Opportunity Fund. Thank you.
So, I suppose the defense that Action will say would give to that is they'd say, well, you know, currently we're spending all this money that's being spent on BEE would instead just, it would be much cleaner. They'd spend about the same amount they spend on BEE. So it's not an additional tax. It's like keeping basically the tax the same, I guess. You, instead of spending on all this complicated BEE compliance, you just pay this 5% and then that will be distributed. for me, I think the second point that Unlu highlighted is the biggest problem with this one. When you know, when you have these big pots of money in the South African state, I don't think this is a problem that only the ANC will suffer from, which is that when you have a giant pot and relatively weak institutions, it's very tempting for government to say, well, you know, our friends, our pet projects, whatever we think is best, you know, our productive causes get the funding from this, and you don't. I don't know, Terence, what do you make on this one? I'm not particularly enthused when I hear Mashaba say something like, trust me, bro, we won't spend the money on patronage networks. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah. Well, look, I think cynicism, given that we live in Mzansi, is always warranted. Okay, my view is a little more charitable. I think there's two things one has to look at. First of all, is what they're looking at taking away, which is BEE. I don't think would have been possible 10 years ago. You know, it's kind of like we've tapped on the outside of the golden carp, and we've discovered there's a ringing emptiness inside it. Yeah, I'm making lots of religious analogies today. And I think that's good. So, you know, let's melt it down. Now, point two, what are they replacing it with? Now, I think this is the devil, ha ha ha, is in the detail. Does this propose doing away with race as a criteria and having some sort of socioeconomic test or metric of benefits? I'm not clear. I'm not sure of that, but you know, I could get behind that. I also imagine
on that point there, their second part of this proposal, the social investment grants, which essentially is a proposal for a universal basic income grant, includes the current means-based test, not a race-based test. I think the implication is that race would be done away with.
Yeah, look, you know, and you know, that's something that we've been saying for decades. I think, funny enough, although there's big fiscal problems around it, the social grant system has been probably the most successful welfare initiative in South Africa, and that is entirely a socioeconomic thing. There are white people who benefit from it, but you know, for objective reasons, objective socioeconomic reasons, the vast majority of people benefiting are black. Now, as I understand, now I would say, if they say, well, 5% of profits or whatever, yes, that's that comes with all sorts of perverse incentives. I imagine, I'm kind of steel manning what I imagine their argument would be, that, well, once we do away with BEE, we will lower the cost structure in general, and South Africa will become a better place to operate. And as we use this money for the infrastructure and the foundations of opportunity, the prospects for making money will be better, and therefore, you know, you essentially won't miss that 5%, or at least in we'll all be making so much more money that we can afford it. Now, that's of course the big if, and that gets back to what has made South Africa effectively uninvestable. You know, if you look at investment to the proportion of GDP is about 15% in South Africa. In middle income countries, it, you know, exceeds 30, gets going up to 40% in some cases. As an average, I think, you know, middle income countries worldwide are kind of north of 30%. So we are underperforming them by half, we are at half their level. So you know, this would have to come with various other adjustments. Now, I know Mashaba himself has spoken about this, the need to reform labor legislation, which I think is a big one. And I think as well, we go back to the principle, do no harm. First of all, don't introduce employment equity rules that say we are going to level a fine that can put you out of business because your spreadsheet because we prefer our spreadsheet to your spreadsheet. You know, let's rather not do that. Maybe we've got a fighting chance in the ring.
Yeah, I think if indeed this policy is applied race neutrally, I think this is definitely a very good step in the right direction in terms of the sort of policy approach, at least compared to what we currently have. And I think, as you say, Terence, it does show that the debate is moving in a more non-racial direction in general. When you have kind of other parties that are, you know, it's not just the DA, it's sort of waving the non-racial flag. I mean, even a few years ago, the DA was basically endorsing BEE, but just saying, oh, we'll do it differently. And now it does seem that the sort of, yeah, exactly. Now the tide is shifting, I think, very much in the other direction, which is in terms of fixing South Africa's problems of poverty, inequality, unemployment. That is, I think, definitely the right direction for the debate to be moving.
Let me just say something which I don't think one can emphasize enough. BEE, BBBEE, or as I say, better black, broad-based black economic empowerment. So I think we've got four Bs now. And I think I can put another E at the end if I really try. Is never defended on its record. It's defended usually in a sort of anodyne generality that without this, you know, we would never have this black middle class, which I don't think is true. I think the big driver there has actually been civil service appointment, but you know, be that as it may. Secondly, it is defended on its intentions. As for a record of achievement, yeah, not really.
Yeah.
And here I'm not talking about reactionary cynics. I'm talking about the people who like this stuff.
Yeah. All right. We are getting kind of close to time. So let's move on to our last story. And that is that after a surprisingly short period of deliberation, the Catholic Church College of Cardinals has elected a new pope. This is to replace Pope Francis, who died towards the end of April after being ill for quite some time. And I suspect that's probably a contributor to why the vote didn't take too long, because I think people sort of were ready to expect it. The Cardinals, I think, had 2 days of which to vote, and this is the Catholic Church is a very old institution, so it has these quite sort of strange, at least to outsiders, voting system, and everyone gets their phones taken away, and they're all kind of sequestered in a thing and sworn to secrecy until the voting is complete, and they announce the election of a new pope with this white smoke that's put out of the Vatican. Over the last couple of conclaves, the average number over the past 10 conclaves, the average number of ballots needed to elect a pope has been 7.2. Pope Francis was elected only with 5 in 2013. And the church has chosen Cardinal Robert Prevost, who is an American born in Chicago, but spent much of his time as a missionary in Peru. During Francis's papacy, was promoted to various positions within the Catholic Church, which is perhaps one of the reasons why he's been chosen as the successor. He's taken the papal name Leo the 14th. So that's what he'll be known as from now on. But Terence, what's your take on this? You are a practicing Catholic. What are your thoughts on the politics and consequences of this election?
Oh yeah, the politics around a papal election, they start way before. Pope Francis, for instance, was elected basically on the second try that his supporters tried to get him in. Initially, what a group that called themselves the St. Gallen Mafia, after a town in Switzerland where they used to meet, tried to get him elected pope after John Paul II's death. So this has been knocking around for a long, long time. It was surprising. I really didn't believe that that a cardinal from the United States would be viable. Just no way. I thought, you know, America is just seen as far too dominant culturally, yeah, you know, the papacy for centuries was very much an Italian institution. Pope John Paul II was from Poland, and then you had a pope from Argentina. Prévost apparently he was very close to Francis. So what you probably can expect is much more of the same. Although it's interesting that his positions on a number of issues are just completely unclear. He's made no comment, for instance, on the Vatican's relationship with China. He seems to be he's opposed to the ordination of women, but he seems to be more inclined towards giving communion to civilly remarried Catholics, which what we tend to see in the in the local press, because I think the quality of journalistic understanding of the Catholic Church is abysmal. It all seems to focus around what's your stance on LGBTQI issues. That is actually a minute part. The big issue that he's going to have to face is the fact that the Vatican is nearly bankrupt, and that it need you know and this was actually one of the things that Pope Francis was tasked with, was actually sorting out the administrative mess, which he did quite a lot of work on, and that was almost entirely absent from any of the obituaries. And so I think that will probably be will probably be his focus. What he does seem to have is the sort of he has the respect of both the traditionalists and the conservatives. So the traditionalists and the modernizers. Once again, I prefer that to left or right or progressives or whatever. So keeping this big wieldy animal together. But he can expect a bumpy ride. The Catholic Church is not a is not a focused group institution. It has 2,000 years of tradition behind it. One of the more interesting details when he was announced is that he delivered his speech in Italian and Spanish. He didn't use English, and I suspect that what he was deliberately doing there was he was appealing both to tradition by using Italian and also to the church's, call it global south. He speaks, I think, about four languages. But if you look at areas where the Catholic Church has is strong in the global south, Spanish is often the lingua franca, and as I say, Italian is has a certain tradition in established Vatican politics. He knows the institution well, so we shall see. Would probably not have been my choice, but there again, when I sent them an email and asked if I could come and vote, they didn't respond. So their server's probably not working.
So Andrew, I must admit I'm very ignorant about the internal dynamics of the Catholic Church, its politics, all these sort of things. So I won't ask you to comment too much on anything of what Terence has said. But what kind of struck me actually was how wrong most of the sort of mainstream commentary on how this election would go was. From what I read, I don't think Cardinal Prevost's name came up as the front runner even once. It was
No.
always just sort of at the bottom of a list somewhere. And it's kind of interesting how there's an awful lot of analysis that goes on about some of these things, which, as it turns out, doesn't seem to be particularly well informed. I don't know. Am I being unfair? What's your takeaway on all this as an outsider?
Firstly, I agree with you. I think we woke up this morning with 10 times more know-it-alls about the Pope and the Catholic history. So I'm not going to pretend to be one of those. Definitely not. But I also made a few points that was quite interesting to me. And Terence briefly mentioned the fact that well, he's unsure, not entirely clear stance on female or women in the hierarchies. And according to something that I read, there's like 10,000 nuns that's leaving every year. For the decade between 2012 and 2022. I don't know if that's a lot or little, but that seems like quite a significant amount of nuns to be leaving each year. And then, yeah, your question about whether his name was a front runner, I also didn't pick it up. But what I noticed is in an interview his brother gave, he mentioned that their neighbor said to, well, Pope Leo, that when they were kids, that he'd be the first American pope. So if that is true, absolutely wild, and she definitely saw it coming. We should keep her on the radar for, if she is still alive, that's it. But I don't have much else to add. I think there's quite a few things that will be on his plate. And I'm reminded, with all respect, I am reminded of the famous quote or answer, if you go to Miss World or Miss Universe, world peace is my main aim. So good luck to him.
Just if I can add, there is a saying in Italy, he who goes into the conclave as a pope will always come out as a cardinal. Never know these things until they're over, and it's also a very, very good saying to keep in mind about South African politics. And to our our viewer who says the Vatican broke, yes, the Vatican has severe financial problems. The fact that it has prices of art treasures doesn't resolve a major liquidity crisis.
And I would be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity, Anlu, and you mentioning all these nuns leaving the church. That's something I suspect they'll be very worried about, because if this trend continues, they might in the end be none. And with that, let's call it to a close. Thank you very much, everyone, for watching today. We hope you found the show interesting, and we'll see you all next week. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful weekend.